Srimadando.
Maheshwarya
Srimadando.
Maheshwarya Srimadando.
Dandapanim napasyati.
Dandapanim napasyati.
Dandapanim napasyati.
Dandapanim napasyati.
Tam brahmasyami sampadyo. Tam brahmasyami sampadyo. Yasya chicham yanugraham.
Yasya chicham
anugraham.
Yasya chicham anugraham.
Nation.
Andha.
Rendered blind.
Danda.
With the rod of punishment. Panim.
In my hand.
Napasyati.
One does not see.
Tam.
Him.
Brahmasyami.
I make four.
Sampadbhya.
Sampadbhya.
From his material assets.
Yasya.
Of whom?
Cha.
And.
Ichami.
I desire.
Anugraham.
Benefit. Translation. A man blinded by intoxication with his power and opulence cannot see me nearby with the rod of chastisement in my hand. If I desire his real welfare, I drag him down from his materially fortunate position. Translation. Please repeat. A man blinded by intoxication, with his power and opulence,
cannot see me nearby
with the rod of chastisement in my hand.
If I desire his real welfare,
I drag him down
from his materially fortunate position.
Purport. One may argue, God should desire everyone's welfare, and therefore why should Krishna state in this verse that he removes the intoxicating opulence of one who is about to receive his mercy, rather than simply stating that he will remove everyone's opulence and bless everyone. On the other hand, we may point out that irrevocable death occurs for everyone, and thus Lord Krishna does take away everyone's opulence and everyone's false pride. However, if we apply the Lord's statement to events within one's immediate life before death, we may then refer to Krishna's statement in Bhagavad Gita 4.11, Yeyutamam prapadyante tams tataiva bhajamyaham. As people surrender to me, I reward them accordingly. Lord Krishna desires everyone's welfare, but when he says here, yasya chamyaham anugraham, for one whose welfare I desire, it is understood that the Lord refers to those who by their own activities and thoughts have manifested a desire to achieve spiritual benefit. Lord Krishna wants to be happy. Lord Krishna wants everyone to be happy in Krishna consciousness. But when he sees a specific person also desire spiritual happiness, the Lord especially desires that for that person. This is a natural act of reciprocation consistent with the Lord's statement, Samoham Sarva Bhuteshu. I am equal in my attitude to all living beings. So there's an interesting point here. Om Ajnana Timham Dasya Gina Gina Sarakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jena. Tasmai Shri Gurudev Namaha. So there's an interesting point here that Krishna, he does drag everyone down from their false position of false pride. And how does he do that?
Death.
Because none of us have a firm idea or understanding where we will be next. For example, when one sees a newborn baby just come into this world, one can think about 2 years ago, I wonder where the soul was, because 2 years ago that soul was located in another body with another mother, another father, another everything. So that's pretty striking. And the same thing is there when you see a body where somebody has just passed on. We use the word passed on. And Srila Prabhupada, quite profoundly, in a couple of places, he says that when the people are crying, all the family members are crying, and they see the body is there, and you come and you say, what's the difficulty? There's no problem. The person you loved is still there. They're there, look. You can see them with your eyes. And the person who's bereaved will say, no, they have passed away. They have passed on. So right in that statement is indicated that the soul or the life of the person who you love has gone somewhere else. And then Srila Prabhupada gives a chilling comment when he's speaking on this subject. He says, that means that the person who was your father, he uses the example of a father, the person who was your father, you never knew. And then you start to think for a minute. I never knew my father. Of course I knew my father. He picked me up and carried me, played games with me, he talked to me, he reciprocated with me in so many ways. But he's saying, no, you never knew your father, because the body that you loved is still there. Just as when someone is asleep, if a young child runs into a room and sees their father asleep and they want some attention, they shake him and he opens his eyes, and again they begin their exchange. But why don't we shake a dead body and say, let's go, we've got some exciting things to do? Why do we instead become a little horrified and uncomfortable and want to perhaps leave the room? Or if it's somebody very near and dear to us, we feel great bereavement. Why? It's the same body is there. I had an interesting, powerful experience that I can relate. When I was travelling with Suchi Rani Mataji, who was living with us in Perth, and we decided that because she had been diagnosed as terminal, we should see if there was anything we could do to extend her life. So we travelled to different places looking for some benefit for her. And we ended up, our travel was around the world ticket, from Perth, around the world, via Vrindavan and back to Perth. So we travelled together from Perth to Melbourne, from Melbourne to New Zealand to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to South America to England, England to Germany, this is going around the world, Germany to Delhi, Delhi to Vrindavan, and there in Vrindavan she left this world. So there I was, it was time for me to go home, Delhi to Bangkok, Bangkok to Perth, and this last leg I would be doing it alone. So it was a little bit unnerving. I remember I got to the airport with my ticket, my only one ticket, and I got through all of the different things you have to do and sat down on the plane, and the seat beside me was very empty, and it was a very strange feeling, and I was looking at the seat and thinking, And then I was thinking after that, because I was trying to keep myself in an auspicious frame of mind, because her departure was so auspicious. So I was trying to keep my mind like that. So I thought, I wonder, in a positive way, who will sit in that seat? So no one sat in the seat, and everybody got ready to leave. And then suddenly a very tall young man with kind of matted hair looked Indian, but he didn't look Indian in his disposition, but he was dark-skinned. He came and he sort of tried to move past me as politely as he could, and he sat down in the seat. So after a while I thought, I was curious, so I said to him, I hope you don't mind, I'm just curious how you got this seat. And he said, well, I was up there, I was supposed to sit up there, but somebody took my seat and they insisted I come down here, and the air hostess told me to come and sit right here. So he sat down. So then as we were sitting for some time, we began to talk. And then I told him, you know why the seat is empty? And he said, no. And I said, it's because I was traveling all around the world with my friend. But she just died. And she's now, so the seat is empty. And so he was very sobered by the subject matter. So then I started to explain to him how we were souls. We were not bodies, we were souls. And it was difficult, theoretically, to share such a conversation with a young man who was just on his way for some pleasure somewhere in the world. But it was so obvious when I had to say to him, this seat here is empty because a soul left its body. It left and went somewhere else. The soul left. It's so clear. It's so clear to me and it was so clear to him. It was so untheoretical. When you just have touched the feet of death, it's so untheoretical. Everything is clear for that short time. But then, of course, because it's unnerving, it's an unnerving experience to be in contact with death, because there's a finalization to everything that we don't want. We want to pursue so many plans, ideas, expectations, and so on and so forth. And so this cut-off, we don't welcome it. And neither she welcomed it, neither I welcomed it, neither we welcomed it when it was Srila Prabhupada, who was going to depart from our midst in the physical sense. We didn't welcome what we would possibly experience thereafter, thinking that in our innocence and our immaturity that his physical departure would mark somehow or other the end, because this is a materialistic way of thinking. So here, when I was reading just even this purport this morning, I was thinking this idea of seeing Krishna standing near me, just near me here, with a rod of chastisement in his hand, isn't appealing. I will speak for myself at least here and show my own embarrassing state of mind. I don't want him to be standing there with a rod of chastisement. He should be offering him, have things in his hands to give me, you know, all the things I've been praying for all these years. I'm thinking that he's a little slow in delivering, but he's standing right there and they're coming. A rod of chastisement. And then I noticed myself thinking, well, a rod of chastisement, of course, look what Indra did. He deserves to be punished. He's done such a horrible thing, and he caused so much disruption, and he was so cruel and heartless, and wanted to kill all the animals. He wanted to kill all these people. He disrupted the Lord's pastimes. The rod of chastisement is very appropriate. But then when I read the next line, if I desire his real welfare, somebody's real welfare, I drag him down from his materially fortunate position. So then I found myself being the person who was asked to speak on the subject matter, asking myself, do you like that idea that Krishna, when he really desires to help us, he'll drag us down from our material position? And I didn't want to answer my own question, because I guess the answer would be no. I wouldn't like to be dragged down from my comfortable material position. I would like to keep everything as it is, and also I would like to go up, ascend towards perfection. But make sure that you don't touch anything, because it's all here. I put it here, I earned it. I worked very hard for that. I'm very fond of this. And this was a gift of my mother. So it has special significance. And on and on and on and on. And I have my whole life all rearranged like a beautiful palace. And I want to keep it there. And the unpleasant parts, sometimes I can sweep them a little to the side. Put them somewhere out of the way so I don't have to look very much at them. And I would like it to stay this way, please. And your mercy is what I have made of. Please give me your mercy. And this is how an intoxicated person thinks. And it was difficult for me to wear the hat. My mind was not exactly eager to think about this. So when this question was raised, one may argue, if God should desire everyone's welfare, why would Krishna state in this verse that he removes the intoxicating opulence of one who is about to receive his mercy, rather than simply stating that he will remove everyone's opulence and bless everyone. When I had read just the first one may argue, my argument had already arisen. Why should God be so punishing? Why does he punish his devotees? Why doesn't he, I had a different question, why doesn't he just bless them? Why does he involve any kind of chastisement, correction? We want him. Shouldn't he just kind of like make everything easy for us? We're trying to become his devotees. So this was the question that arose in my mind. And I was thinking, I don't know, because you're hearing rather than reading in front of you, whether such a question would arise in your minds also, if you were asked to sit and prepare a class on this subject. Why doesn't he just bless us? And it's so difficult for the conditioned soul to see the things that are placed between them and Krishna that they want there. It's so difficult to see this. Because these things are all connected to our identity right now. I am a mother, I am a father, I am an Australian, I am an Indian, I am this, I am that, this is my culture, this is my that. So many things are there. And when we go to the Bhagavad Gita, we hear so many philosophical words, and we may appreciate those words. But to actually take them and put them, implement them in our consciousness, is a mighty task, because it demands realization of them. They sometimes stay over here, philosophy is over here, and my life is over here. And I take a little from there when I need it. If life is a bit difficult, I take a little look at the philosophy. Otherwise, I try to work it out myself, because I don't want to be weak. I want to be responsible. So I try to work it out myself. And in the last resort, I say, I'm sorry to bother you, but I need some help. Please help me, and some help will come. But otherwise, I go on quite nicely alone. But this isn't the mentality of somebody who's been blessed. This is the sober reality that we have to hear and we have to share with each other. This is not the mentality of an advanced, exalted Vaishnava. Srila Prabhupada one time was feeding ducks, swans, and they were in a lake. And some of the swans, he had some bread and he was throwing pieces. And some of the swans came very, very, very near and made a loud quacking sound, because they wanted to feed. And some of the swans stayed sort of back. They were somewhat interested, but it wasn't that important to them. And so Srila Prabhupada was throwing the bread. And as I recall this being described to me, he threw the bread largely to the ones who were wanting it. They were squawking, they were hungry. And he, by his mercy, he threw something to those ones who were more distant. But those ones who really wanted it, it's just natural to give them something. And they would look around when it didn't come to them, why not me? And again try, please, 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 I want something. So he explained afterwards that this is also the mood of Krishna. When we really want him, he has to give us so much of his mercy. When it's, we can take or leave, then what happens is the part of us that is wanting, the percentage of our heart that is wanting, he'll reciprocate with that. But the material energy will reciprocate with the rest. And so you'll get a mixed result. You'll get a result of being given so many things by the material energy, because you want these things for your material prosperity here in this world, relating to your body, relating to this world. I need this, I need this, I want that, I want that. They will come. And at the same time, Krishna will respond with his gift also. But here he's saying that my real mercy comes when I say, no more of this. Now I want to give you only me. And then who wants it? This is our misfortune. Who really wants this from Krishna? How many of us are brave enough and strong enough to say, yes, that's what I want. Please put it in my hands. Rather, we say, a little bit is enough. Thank you. I can go on with all my activities. So Indra was thinking like this also. He's a powerful man. He had so much at his disposal. Women, family members, a beautiful place to live, beautiful gardens where he lives. And everybody there lives a long life, and they're pious. They're not crude. They're not ugly. They're not angry. They're not violent. So he's very comfortable. And why would therefore Krishna give him so much difficulty? Because he wanted to remove, as we hear in the beginning of this story, the mountain of Indra's false pride. Indra was thinking, because I have all of this, I deserve something. I deserve the respect and worship of all those people who receive rain. Because I am the controller of the rain. When I give the rain, they should respond by worship of me. And Krishna specifically wanted to do two things by performing this particular lila. He wanted to allow Indra to be exposed in his, you could say, at his bare roots. And also he wanted to turn that situation into a wonderful festival. And that festival is still going on today. So this is Krishna's amazing mercy. On one side, Indra was humiliated. He was embarrassed. He was corrected by Krishna directly, personally, for his personal benefit in his position and post. And on the other side, Krishna used that same unfortunate, embarrassing situation of Indra and turned it into a wonderful festival for everyone who comes to the good fortune of knowing anything about Vrindavan, Govardhan Hill, or this particular pastime. And on the day that this festival, that Indra performed this very angry act, if you happen to have the opportunity to be in Vrindavan at Govardhan Hill on that particular day, literally thousands and thousands and thousands, you can't almost imagine how many people are circumambulating Govardhan Hill, all dressed in bright, colorful clothes, happy, joyful of this event, praying to Giriraj to give them some blessing of some sort. All of them participating in this very, very auspicious occasion. Yet this occasion was the circumstance under which Indra, first of all, had to be separated from something. He had to be separated, at least momentarily, from his pride of position. Now we continue on with Krishna's words to Indra. In the next verse he says, Indra, you may go now. Execute my order and remain in your appointed position as the King of Heaven. But be sober, without false pride. And the purport, it is said that Krishna here addressed Indra in the plural form, because Sanskrit as a plural of all the pronouns. So he used the word va, because this grave instruction was meant to be a lesson for all the demigods. So then we also come to hear that very soon he told him, he didn't tell him, you're free from your false pride. He said, be careful of false pride. Because later, for Krishna's pastime, just as this was turned into a pleasure pastime, Indra again would manifest that same pride, and Krishna again would challenge Indra's position by taking something that he felt was his. So how difficult it is to actually live in the understanding of Krishna and his position and our position. It is very, very challenging. And if we want to do it, rather than occasionally seeking Krishna's mercy, we will find that we have to seek his mercy constantly. And constantly he will give it. He's wanting to reciprocate with us and give us mercy. And the need for the thunderbolt and the chastisement is for the part of our heart and mind and faulty intelligence that thinks that I don't need him. I can do everything on my own. I'm quite capable, and therefore I don't have any interest in him and his position. So as we dovetail our activities more and more in his service, this part of our consciousness is expected to become slowly, 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 slowly reduced. And as that takes place, the other side gradually, gradually, gradually increases in brilliance until we actually can perceive for ourselves Krishna's mercy in our lives, and we can stay there and not slip back into forgetfulness of Him. So does anyone have any questions on this subject? Any thoughts? Yes.
You gave an example of how to feel self, yes. The ego and just naturally. But when you learn to ask the ship for
why would one feel not deserving?
Because there's a qualification to superficial gratitude.
What is the qualification? Where does it come from? In a devotee, where does that love come from? So if it's natural, does it come from who we think we are now? Who we might feel is undeserving? No, it comes from the soul, and the soul's identity is pure. So therefore one is deserving. And then one will feel, observing one's present distracted position perhaps, or fallen condition and so forth, that will give one more need, not less need. Because I myself am pure, but look at me now. So please, coming from me, the pure soul, is this. I'm in a very difficult position because I've got all of this covering me and surrounding me. But in essence, I'm deserving. Everyone is deserving. But we have to trace it back through the layers of ego and mind to that essential point. And that's why we need to hear Krishna philosophy, because then we can go penetrate through the difficulties of our present conditioned state of mind. Do you understand? Then we are deserving.
And so how do you get calling out the
concept? Do it as much as you can, and then if you do a little bit more, you'll always be improving. You just keep doing a little bit more. If you try to flip from here to there, I'm not doing it all, I'm going to do it all the time, it won't be possible. But if you do it a little bit more, by definition, then you do it a little bit more, and a little bit more, you're increasing. Then you're going up towards that. And that's very hopeful. Then it's just a matter of time. And when it becomes difficult, you might have the pattern in place, the habit in place, that I take shelter. And so when difficulties arise, we do it more. And then the difficulties become our friends, actually, because they actually push us even further towards what we want. Any other points on that? Or questions? Yes.
Sometimes, quite often, particularly if you have just simple desires, we often want to take shelter of our body and say, well, it's only something simple, I don't want to test Krishna, because we're not meant to just continually just test Krishna. So I'll just go out and I'll get a job and I'll do all of this sort of stuff. So in a sense, we're surrendering to ourselves rather than to Krishna.
Yeah.
So to what degree should you balance that between testing Krishna and...
Well, this testing, it's interesting you use the word testing, because there are other things you could say, I don't want to, this is just a human thought, but I don't want to inconvenience him, I don't want to disturb him, I don't want to displease him. Those things are all like considerate, but test him is a little bit Lord Brahma tried to do. He wanted to test him. And there's a little bit of insolence in testing somebody, right? I'm just going to test and see if you can come. So if there's a hint of testing in our endeavor, that hint is not so welcome, because it's like if you're the first grade student, you've only just learned to write an A, and you want to test the headmaster. It's a little out of proportions to your position. Yet we may not want to disturb him, or we may not want to, we may feel that this is just a little thing. Why should I bother him? And also I'm capable of making this decision. Then Srila Prabhupada pointed out to ourselves when we made certain decisions that we should check whether the decision is the most favorable one for us. There's a facility that's required to keep us from going too far to the left or too far to the right, and that comes through making some checking to see whether this is going the best time for me to do this and so forth. And that would have to come through persons whose maturity in Krishna consciousness you respect. Sometimes there's something that you can check by reading that this is my, but generally you're checking your attitude, not your activity. So to change, for example, the attitude of test to the attitude of something more submissive, some advice may be given to you, why don't you do this for now, or something like that. But generally we're checking our attitude. We're checking. Any other? Alright, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam.